Daddy does, putting his foot up on the kitchen stool and saying, "Little Ship Walker here." He wears cowboy boots just like Daddy and acts like he's the boss of the world. Then before you know it, we're all back in the creek for a late afternoon swim, and everyone has cleared out except for only us. We wait until the sun is just starting to go down, and then we take our baths. The yayas all get bars of ivory soap, and we suds up and rub that lather all over our bodies, and you can hear the cicadas cranking up. And you suds up your hair, too. Then close your eyes and dive into the water and rinse it out. You smell that ivory and the creek water and see the little bitty ones with their swimsuits off getting bathed by their mamas. And the yayas are washing their hair, too, and everybody's laughing, and little Shep and me are making our hair stand up in points. These are our real baths, because we'd run that well dry in no time flat if we all tried to use the shower back at the camp. We get to take our swimsuits off underwater, but only the little ones can just pop up naked. But then one evening, Caro says, "Oh, bathing with a swimsuit on is just ridiculous." And she takes off her swimsuit and flings it over by the towels. And so the older yayas go right ahead and do the same thing. And so, of course, all the rest of us take ours off, too. And that makes it 4 mamas and 16 kids skinny dipping. We have that whole place to ourselves, and they start singing one of their old camp songs. "Once I went in swimming where there were no women and no one to see. Hung my little britches on the willow switches of a nearby tree. Came a little villain, stole my underwear, and left me with a smile." And we're all laughing, and little Shep is trying to sing real deep like a grown-up man, and Sita's long red hair is floating on her shoulders, and Lulu is sunburned, and Niecy's little ones are splashing and jumping up and down, and you can see the yaya's breasts, but they just look like mamas, and it's not a big deal. And we just keep bathing and playing, and oh, it is such a sweet evening. Me and Sita take that ivory in our hands and shoot it up in the air. And when it lands, it's so pure, it floats like on TV. Then Mama gets her famous idea of swinging off the rope swing. Niecy stays with the little ones, but all the rest of us climb up on the bank. We get on the rope, 2 at a time, and swing out buck naked and drop down into the water yelling, "Aye!" As long as I'm careful not to get rope burned, it's exactly like flying. Landing in that water when it's not quite dark yet, just lingering summer light on our bodies, and the water and the trees and the crickets and us. It only lasts for a little while because darkness comes, but it feels like it lasts forever. Then we're back on the bank, and the ladies are drying our hair, and we're all whining, "I'm hungry, I'm starving, Mama." And the yayas say, "We'll be home in a minute, don't worry. We'll get something in your stomach in 5 minutes. And would you believe it? A car with a red bubble light on top pulls up and shines its headlights on us like we're deer in the middle of the road or something. All the ladies scramble to wrap towels around themselves or throw on their swimsuit cover-ups. Mama is reaching for her striped terry cloth one with the hood, and this short, fat sheriff gets out of the car and says, "What the hell's going on here?" "Oh, Lord," Mama says, "some Baptist must have called and told on us." And the yayas all start giggling. Lil Shep can't believe an actual sheriff is standing there, and he just walks straight up to the man and touches his gun. The sheriff says, "Get your hands away from that, son. That's no toy. That's a real man's firearm." I know, little Shep says, lying through his teeth. My daddy's got 10 of them. Which is not true. Daddy doesn't have pistols like that. Only shotguns. Mama says, little Shep, come back over here. The sheriff looks at Mama and says,
well, I should have known. Vivi Abbott and the gang. As if y'all weren't trashy enough when y'all came out here as teenagers, ruining this place with all y'all carrying on. Now y'all come out here with your innocent little children and expose them to your pervert behavior. I should run y'all in on a morals charge.
All the ladies are covered up by now, and I think for a minute that things are going to get bad. And that sheriff is rocking on his heels like he is the king of the universe. Then Caro says, Sheriff Modine, I do believe you have put on weight. Then the yayas really lose it. They start laughing, and they can't stop. The headlights of the patrol car are shining on the yayas' painted toenails and their wet hair. When I look up, they look like mermaids. How dare this man come and do this to Mama and her friends? I go over to the sheriff and kick him in the leg. Leave us alone, you chubby, I tell him. He grabs for me, but Mama comes and pulls me back, still laughing, and says,
Bay, it's okay, honey, really.
And she picks me up, even though I'm too big to be carried, and the ladies are just howling. They gather us all up and ignore that fat sheriff, and they lead us over to the T-Bird and Niecy's station wagon and start piling us in. The sheriff is yelling out at us.
I don't care who your families are. You're not in Thornton now. You're in Spring Creek. We don't act like heathens here. Women like y'all shouldn't be allowed to have children.
Once we're in the car, Mama floors it. Niecy and Carol are right on our tail, and Mama lays on the horn and blows it all the way out from the creek and halfway down the road. We're all crooking our necks to see if Sheriff Modine is following us, and he does part of the way, but by the time we reach our turnoff, he keeps on going straight, and then we all start hooting and hollering. All right, we yell, yay us! Back at the camp, the yayas tell us, now y'all go get your pajamas on. All of us head in and start pulling pajamas out of the chest and putting them on. My skin is all wrinkled from being in the water so long, and my fingernails are white. Lulu says, Baylor, would you rub some solar cane on my back? And I do. And Gavin and Bernard, Carol's twins, start a fight, but their big brother Hale, who's Lil Shep's age, says, hey, y'all, cut that out, or I'm going to give y'all two knuckle sandwiches. And if you think that sheriff scared my mama and her friends, you are wrong. No. This is what they do. They get out of their swim cover-ups and put on their shorts and tops and build a fire in the pit, and we all have a weenie roast. Mama rubs 612 all over us, and we turn our hot dogs in the flames, and the ladies help us put mayonnaise and ketchup on the buns, and we have this huge wooden bowl of potato chips and tall cold bottles of Cokes, and the ladies are drinking Cold Jack's beer out of the red cooler. And we lay up in our hammocks, and then somebody goes inside and brings out a bag of Oreos that we lick the centers out of before we eat the cookie part. And next thing you know, the yayas are pretending to be Sheriff Modine, strutting around the fire, grabbing at their crotches, spitting, clearing their throats. Niecy is laughing so hard she falls on the ground and kicks her feet up and down. But Mama and Carol keep on snorting and stomping, making fun of that sheriff's accent, saying, I ought to turn y'all in on a morals charge. We stay outside with the fire and the stars and the hammocks and the mosquito coils and the lightning bugs. And we sing, Tell Me Why the Stars Do Shine. They teach us to sing it in rounds, and we sing it over and over, up into the trees and the sky, and things are so quiet around us. That song is like a bedtime prayer in the night air, and no one is laughing anymore. It's not that we're sad. It's just that it's nighttime, and we've had a full day, and we're getting sleepy, although nobody wants to break away from our circle around the fire. I must have fallen asleep, because the next thing I remember, one of the yayas, I don't know which one, is dusting the sand off the bottom of my feet and tucking me in bed. And the feather pillow is soft, and the chenille bedspread is the perfect weight on my body. And the ceiling fan is whirring steady. The blades of that fan just circle round and round all night while I sleep. All night long while I dream, that fan keeps me cool. It keeps the bugs from biting me. It keeps the boogeyman away. It stops all the things under my bed from reaching up and grabbing me, like they're always down there waiting to do. Bookworms. Vivian, 1964. Sitta can't help herself. She just loves books. Loves the way they feel, the way they smell. Loves those black letters marching across the white pages. When Sitta falls in love with a book, she is positive that she is the very first person in the world to have discovered it. Poor child. Thinks that no one else anywhere, anytime, has ever heard of the book. I'll never forget the time she flipped over The Secret Garden, which Buggy gave her. She lived inside that book for days. You couldn't even talk to the child. Then, after a while, she went to the library and looked that book up, and when she found out that other copies existed, and all kinds of people had their names on the borrower's card, she just broke down in tears. She had truly believed that she was the only one who had ever read that book. After that, everywhere she went, she stared at people, trying to figure out which one of them had trespassed on her book. Of course, I simply adore books myself. I get Reader's Digest condensed books every month of God's World and devour every single one of them. There is nothing I like better than holing up in my bedroom with a Coke and a Snickers bar and Pearl S. Book. Pearl S. Book is magnificent. All the detail she puts in her writing. In The Good Earth, where she has the man wake up and wash himself before he comes to his wife in the morning. Well, that just slays me. It is so tender. And he was Chinese to boot. I should have been a writer myself. I taught Sitta to read when she was 4 years old, before the nuns even got their hands on her. Jessie claims she is the one who taught the child to read, but then my sister would claim she gave birth to my daughter, if I wasn't around to contradict her. I usually take Sitta to the library once a week while Little Shep has his tennis lessons. Sitta took tennis for a while, too, but she just could not take the heat. The child did not inherit my abilities on the court. I was the captain of the tennis team at Thornton High. Everybody knows that. I get the biggest kick out of watching Sitta in the library. She is so serious, the way she carries her library card in that little purse of hers. You'd think she was a grown woman with a Neiman Marcus charge card. The librarian will make suggestions about books for her age group, but they're always years below her reading level. The nuns tested the fifth graders and said Sitta has the reading skills of a high school junior. Well, I could have told them that. The child used the word impeccable before she even started first grade. Regardless of her reading level, I cannot allow her to read everything simply because she can. She is just too young. Some of the books that child is able to rip through are not even approved Catholic reading. I have to look over her choices carefully to make sure she isn't sinning due to her gift of intelligence. Being a Catholic can be très fatigué sometimes.
Sitta and I simply love the City Park Library. They have several good window air conditioners in there, and those floors are waxed so smooth that the wooden chairs just glide when you pull them out from the reading table. For her light reading, Sitta goes into the juvenile section for Nancy Drew or Chair Ames. Then she crosses over into adult fiction for her more serious stuff. She is in the Great Books Club, which you have to be invited to join, and they have their recommended list as well. Some of the great books I've never so much as heard of, so I sometimes wonder just how great they really are. I mean, I'm not exactly what you'd call illiterate. The child would have died if they hadn't asked her into that club. She always corrects me, saying, "Mother, it's not the Great Books Club, it's just Great Books Club." She comes home agitated after every single one of the meetings. She cannot stand Mrs. Chauvin, who heads up the thing. Cannot take that woman tearing those books apart like a head of lettuce. To Sitta and me, books are living things with blood and bones, and it breaks our heart when people dissect them. I can't blame my daughter. I don't like Abby Chauvin either. She thinks she is the Lauren Bacall of Thornton simply because she went to Sarah Lawrence. But I tell Sitta, you have got to try and get along in groups, honey, even if the woman is asinine. Sitta's eye still wanders a little, still drifts off to the right, but only when she is very tired. Thank God I got her the eye operation, or she might not be able to make out a stop sign. Or she'd be seeing double, not even able to read a sentence straight through. That's the whole reason why I got her the eye operation. Not just because a wandering eye is unflattering to a girl, like Shep claimed. He just could not bear it that I knew what to do, and he didn't. He couldn't stand the fact that I was stronger than him, that I was smarter. He ups and leaves for the goddamn duck camp every time anything happens in this house. Coward of a Baptist that he is. But don't get me started. Shep does love to read, I will give him that. We fight over who gets to read a new book first. Then, after we've both finished a book, we sit in the kitchen eating ham sandwiches, talking about it, sometimes arguing just for the fun of it. He never admits it, but he gets just as excited about reading as I do. He hurries in from the fields early when he thinks the Reader's Digest condensed books is in the mailbox. If I've already run out there and gotten it and started reading, he'll come in and pretend to pout and try and snatch it out of my hands to make me laugh. The library will only let Sitta and me check out two books at a time, which drives us nuts. We live in the country, I tell the librarian. We need more than just two books to last us. My daughter and I are fast readers. We are avid. But the old bat behind the counter says, "Two books a patron. That's our limit, no matter where you live." Sometimes I watch my daughter smuggle an extra book out, and even though I know I should, I just cannot bring myself to stop her. Sometimes you just have to reach out and grab what you want, even when they tell you not to. This is something that I have struggled with my whole life long. Another way Sitta gets around the two-book limit is to also check out books from the bookmobile when it comes around every 2 weeks. The Garnet Parish bookmobile is just an old panel van lined with shelves of books with one teeny nook where a person can sit down and a closet where they keep their supplies. The one thing I'll say for it is air-conditioned. If it weren't, you'd smother to death in there before getting through 4 chapters of a dime store romance. Sitta made friends with Lenora, the lady who drives the thing, and Lenora saves books for Sitta, even though she isn't supposed to. How can you resist a child like my daughter when it comes to reading? She is so bright and intelligent, she should have been a boy. When I want to punish her, all I have to do is take away whatever book she's involved with at the time, and she suffers madly. See, she goes places when she reads. I know all about that. When I'm reading, wherever I am, I'm always somewhere else. Sitta is always trying to read at the table, But I wasn't raised that way, and I'm not going to let her get away with it either. If I have to sit there and listen to all the shit that goes on around that table, then so does she. The bookmobile doesn't come all the way out to Pecan Grove. It stops up at the top of Pecan Road, just like the DDT truck does. Thornton won't send the damn DDT truck all the way to Pecan Grove because we're legally outside the city limits, so we have to suffer mosquitoes the size of blackbirds. I'm surprised we don't all get malaria and die. Sometimes my whole life feels like a nightmare where I'm trying to keep bugs from eating my beautiful children alive. The kids have figured out a way to get one over on the city, though. They ride their bikes behind the DDT truck when it comes out, and they let those clouds of white chemicals just swirl around and settle all over them. Their whole little bodies get coated with that fine dust, and they come back and play outside till midnight and don't get one single bite. Like they aren't even in the heart of Louisiana. They beg and beg not to take a bath, just so that DDT will linger on their skin and they can go another day without being bitten to death by the bloodsuckers. So anyway, one night, Shep and I have a little too much to drink. He's sunburned from the fields, and I'm shaky to begin with. He does something, and I do something back. We have this big screaming fight in the kitchen, and he scratches out in the truck and doesn't come home that night. Probably just spends the night at the duck camp. I'm used to that. But he always comes home early the next morning to shower and change into fresh clothes for the day. The next morning, though, he doesn't show up, and I get possessed by the idea that he's been killed in a car wreck, the way my own father died, leaving me forever without saying a word. So I get a little upset. I wake the kids up screaming, "Your daddy is dead." I tell them, "Wake up. We gotta find him. Get up. I can't do this all by myself." Sitta is my right-hand man, as usual, and I get her to call the state police, then Lyle Rotea of Rotea's Bar. Nobody's seen my husband, that son of a bitch. Sitta is all organized, gets a spiral notebook and a sharpened pencil, and writes everything down. She talks like a little adult when the people answer the phone. I have taught all my children impeccable telephone manners. I fix me a mimosa and say, "Sitta, call his goddamn buddies. Call Sim. Call that damn Bernard. Call your Uncle Pete." She grabs the phone list and starts dialing. I take a snippet of a mill town and sit there at the breakfast table and stare out the window. I'm tempted to bite my nails, but I'll be damned if I'll let Shep Walker ruin my manicure just because he has disappeared. Then Sitta comes over to me and stands real close. She says, "Mama, nobody knows where he is. Nobody has seen Daddy." I say, "He is dead. I'm 100% positive. I can feel it." I fix another mimosa, and I relax a little. Then I tell Sitta, "Hand me the phone. I'll take over now. Go away and play with matches." She starts that hyperventilating and splotching up that she does just to get attention, and I say, "Darling, I'm just kidding." She studies me for a minute. I say, "Don't you look at me in that tone of voice. I don't need that. Not today." So she goes on back to her room, and I don't give her a second thought. Well, finally, Shep Walker pulls in around noon asking, "Hey, babe, where's my lunch?" And I am so happy to see him get out of that truck with his sleeves rolled up and that sun-bleached blonde hair on his arms that I completely forget to kill him. And we start to have the loveliest little midday meal together. But Sitta runs in, hysterical, and tries to ruin the whole thing for me and my husband, crying and hanging on to Shep. She sobs, "Daddy, you're still alive." Shep looks at her like she's nuts and says, "Well, yeah, what'd you expect?" I tell her, "Would you please leave him alone and stop being so dramatic, Miss Sarah Bernhardt?" Still doing her sob act, she lets go of my husband and runs out of the room. Shep asks me, "What in the world's wrong with her?" I say, "She just reads too many books." Then I give my husband a kiss. a nasty middle-of-the-day kiss that there are far too few of in this world. My one and only heads out to the fields around 3, and the kids are outside. I call up Waylon's to see if they have gotten in the sun hat I ordered. They can be so damn slow getting you something you want in this town. Lulu and Little Shep and Bayla troop in, sweating up a storm. They lay down in front of the TV to watch the little rascals, and I ask them, "Where is your big sister?" "We don't know," they reply without looking at me. "Last time we saw her was at the bookmobile." Now, usually, Sitta comes straight back with her books and puts the little paper sack covers on them that she likes to make. The child can get a little too particular sometimes. I mean, it is not necessary to put book covers over book covers. I don't know where she gets that kind of thing from. But I am not going to worry. I have worried enough today. I need a rest. So I take a delicious nap, and when I get up, I rub some pretty feet on my toes and give myself a pedicure. You've got to keep your feet in shape during the summer if you don't want to look like an ape in sandals. Well, Sitta doesn't show up for supper, which is a first. I mean, it's not like we live in a neighborhood, for God's sake. We live at the end of a gravel road on 900 acres. There isn't anybody she can drop in on. It's getting dark, and I start to worry. Shep gets home, and he's cleaning up in the utility room. I go in there and tell him, "Babe, Sid is gone." He says, "What do you mean, gone?" "I mean, we don't know where in the world she is. She's been gone all afternoon."
"God damn it," he says.
We start off by calling her little girlfriends who live in town. First off, the ones from the Great Books Club. Not one of them has heard a peep from her. That bitch, Abby Chauvin, says,
"You mean you have no idea where your daughter is?"
"That's right," I tell her, "but don't worry your little frosted head about it. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, I think. Please don't let my oldest child be molested and strangled to death. Please, God, don't let a little body be chopped to pieces lying in a culvert off Highway 17. I'm so shook I can't even mix a drink. Shep has to make it for me. We dial up Buggy. "Maybe Sitter's over there," I pray. But Buggy hasn't heard a word from her. Mother says, "Light a candle to the Virgin, and I'll be right over." We call Willetta, and she says, "Call the sisters up at the school." So we do. The nuns answer the phone, and they have the TV going in the background. Shep says,
"So that's what they do with all the money we give them, buy brand new color TV sets."
I say, "Shut up, babe. We've got more important things to do here than criticize the Roman Catholic Church." We call her piano teacher and her dance teacher. Not a thing. It is pitch dark outside with no moon and the smell of rain in the air. Shep and I stand out on the carport, and he asks me for a cigarette. "I thought you quit," I tell him.
He says, "Babe, we're going to have to call the police."
"The police," I scream. "The police looking for my child? My life is getting more like TV all the time." The rest of the kids are agitated as hell, worry shooting through their bodies like electric current. Lulu starts the hair chewing again. I swear I don't know where in the world she picked that up. I have to slap her pudgy little hand and say, "Honey, cut that out. Do you want to be bald-headed before you even start dating?" She starts crying and whines, "I miss Sitta. Where is Sitta, Mama?" Buggy pulls into the driveway about the same time as the police. We give the officer a description of Sitta Lee and one of her school pictures. Then Bayla has to go and rip my heart to shreds just when it is the last thing I need. He runs into his room and gets this picture he's drawn of his big sister and hands it to the officer.
"This is Sitta," he tells the policeman. "This is what she really looks like."
Then he holds out a white cotton shirt of hers and says, "This is what she smells like if you need to get dogs to trace her." Sometimes I don't know which child is the strangest, my oldest or my youngest. I go inside and call up the yaw-yaws. Niecy and Carol come over immediately, even though Carol already has on her pajamas. I set out some cheese and crackers and start to fill the silver ice bucket. I say, Mother, why don't you set out some olives and open a can of artichoke hearts?
Shep says, My God, Vivi, this is not a party.
I scream, Do you want people to starve just because Sitta ran away? He looks at me and my best girlfriends like we're some kind of nuts. Then he takes his keys down from the hook by the toaster. Where do you think you are going? I ask him.
Out to look for my daughter, he says.
Damn you, Shep Walker. You can't walk out and leave me to deal with this by myself. You can't do that to me.
I can't just sit here on my butt eating Ritz crackers, he says, and walks out the door.
I yell after him, When will you be back? I don't even have to hear him reply. Niecy and Carol answer for him in unison. I'll be back when I get back. I smoke 84,000 cigarettes. I refuse to believe that anything has really happened to my daughter. God will not let anything bad happen to my children. I will not let Sitta Lee drive me to the insane asylum like she has tried to do hundreds of times. Mother keeps muttering and praying her damn rosary under her breath until I finally have to jerk it out of her goddamn hands. I tell her, That's all you've ever done in every single emergency of my life. God, you are worse than having no mother at all. I'm immediately sick and ashamed of myself and go to Mother and give her a hug and kiss. I say, I'm sorry, Mama, but this is really throwing me for a loop.
That's all right, Vivian, she tells me. I just pray to God that your daughter running away from you is not punishment for the way you treat me.
The bitch. I stub out my cigarette, although not in Mother's face as I would like. And I walk down the hall into Sitta's room and shut the door behind me. I stand next to her dresser and close my eyes. I don't reach for the lamp, just close my eyes until they adjust to the dark. I stand there and make myself take 10 deep breaths until I can see my daughter's face and her body clearly in my mind. I see her red hair, the brown eyes, the way she lays in bed reading with one eye partially closed. I see her freckles, her lips, the tiny scar on them from when she ran into the wheelbarrow when she was 3. I see her arms and hands, her fingernails that I always tell her to push the cuticles back from when she gets out of the tub. I see her stomach, how it pooches out a little, her butt so tiny. She's going to have a tight little butt like mine, not a big fat butt like her aunt's on Shep's side of the family. I see her little breasts, the way they are starting up. I see her pubic area, where there isn't any hair yet. She is mine. I carried her for 9 months. I lost my waist for her. My feet grew from size 6 to 7.5. I lost my potential for her. I lost my twin boy for her. I could have had twins, but only she lived. He came out first. He was in my womb. He was born. He stayed a while, and then he died. He had Shep's hazel eyes and red hair like Sitta. He would look up at me, and I could see my face in his eyes. He died after 4 days. This is how I was tormented. I laid in the hospital bed at St. Cecilia and cried. I did not want to see anyone, not even the yaw-yaws. No one understood. They said it would pass. Shep said,
Vivi, you've got to stop this. Look at our girl. She is perfect.
He said,
Our baby girl has the most beautiful glittering eyes in this whole hospital.
My twin boy would have made everything work out. He is the one who would have given it all back to me, everything I have lost, and I would have done anything for him. If he would have told me to go to River Street and become a beggar, I would have done it. If he would have said at any time of the night or day, dance with me, I would have carried him in my arms and danced. But Sitta is the one who lived. I paid for her with him. I lay there with the nuns floating in and out, and the sounds of their rustling habits and the hospital noises. I did not want the shades open. I cussed at God until he came to me. Then I said, "Will you comfort me now? Will you take me in your arms and hold me?" But God said the only reason you wanted twins in the first place was to get attention. I was cheated. Children do not bring you attention. They take it all away. After that, I did not talk about my twin boy to anyone. I kept him hidden inside. 2 weeks later, I was at home with Sitta in her bassinet, and the phone rang. It was an insurance salesman. He said, "Don't you want insurance on the twin that lived? You know, Mrs. Walker, she could die too. God forbid." I could not eat after that. I starved my body back down into a size 6, which is where I belong. I drank gin and quinine water to settle my stomach. Then before Sitta was even old enough to turn over by herself, my father rounded Davis Circle too fast and was killed. Before he ever looked at me and saw who I am. And I didn't know it then, but I was already pregnant with little Shep. Part of me spoiled then, and nobody noticed. All they said was, "Vivi Abbott Walker, you look positively gorgeous after all you've been through. Aren't you glad you have that darling little baby girl and another angel on the way?" 4 children, a husband, a house, dripping goddamn boiling water over the chicory coffee every morning of the world. Everything gets sucked out of me. Every ounce of my high school goldenness, every single iota of my college education, gone. The only thing left is the yah-yahs. And now here I am, standing in my missing daughter's room. I can see her navy blue round-toed keds in the closet, her stack of books on the nightstand. I can smell her 11-year-old smell, spicy and new, and in an instant I know exactly where my child is. I fling open her bedroom door and run down the hall. "Carol," I scream, "call the police." She hands me the phone. "The damn police, they treat me like I'm some kind of nut." "Calm down," they say. "We'll handle this." "I hope you burn in hell," I tell them. "Don't you dare treat me like I don't know what I'm talking about. Screw you and the horse you rode in on." I hang up the phone, light another cigarette, and dial so hard I break a fingernail. The mayor himself answers the phone, and I say, "Kid, this is Vivi Abbott Walker." Then I tell him what I need, and he says, "You got it, Vivi." That is the thing about living in a small town. I once dated Kid Gerard. I broke the man's heart while he was at Auburn, sending me telegrams once a week. I know he'll do what I ask, even though he hasn't kissed me on the lips in 22 years. I always tell my 2 daughters, don't ever underestimate the power women have over men, and don't ever let them know you have it either. I make Mother stay with the kids. Then Niecy and Carol drive me in Niecy's station wagon. They are such good friends to me. They keep lighting me ciggies, and Carol has her arm around me saying, "Don't worry, Vivi, we'll find her. We will not let anything happen to that child, you hear?" Niecy drives that station wagon like a bat out of hell, and we beat Kid there. I take some deep breaths and say a prayer to St. Jude, patron saint of the impossible. Sitta could be roasted to death. She could be suffocated like the millions of children who crawl up into abandoned refrigerators, and the door slams shut, and they are locked in there for all eternity. The bookmobile is parked underneath a crepe myrtle behind the library in the gravel parking lot. I get out of the car and take the flashlight I've brought with me and walk over to it. I stand right next to the van, and I can still feel the heat of the day on the outside of it. I try the door, but it's locked. I knock loud and hard. I say, "Sitta, baby, it's okay. Hold on, honey. We'll take you home before you know it." If she's not in there, then it's all over. If she's not in there, then she is nowhere, and I will kill Shep Walker because I am too chicken to kill myself. Then Kid pulls up, looking handsome as ever. He strides over to me with a huge ring of keys and says, "Hey, Vivi,
What can I do for you this evening? I got the keys to unlock anything you want.
I can't believe the man is flirting with me after all these years, and my daughter almost dead. I say, open that bookmobile door, would you please, kid? I think my oldest child is in there. He does just what I say. I love a man who can take orders. I step inside, and it is simply stifling in that van. The air conditioner has been off for hours. She could be dead, I think. Is that what you want, Vivi Walker? Do you want her dead? Sitter, I call out. It's me, baby. It's Mama. That bookmobile is hot as hell. It's a 475-degree gas oven. I shine the flashlight around. No air. No sitter. Once you shut off the air conditioning in a book van and shut the door and windows, it's as good a way as any to commit suicide. I will not throw up. I will not let the thoughts in my head push me over the edge. I will not have a child of mine kill herself. I will not lose the twin and her, too, both without me having any say-so whatever. I shine the light. I can see the titles on the books. Look, there is Hemingway, Papa Ernest. Why did he put a bullet through that gorgeous male head of his? Blood all over that thick, sexy beard. Sitter, I call out. Please, baby, if you're here, please come out. Please. I hear a shuffling. God, listen to me. If you will let her still be alive, I will give up Bombay gin. Maybe not Tanqueray, but definitely Bombay. I walk straight to the tiny storage closet in the back and open the door. I follow my instincts. One thing I have is instincts. There she is, crouched in there, hiding from me. I bend down to her. I want to kill her. Then Kid is at my side. He says, I'll be damned if this is not female intuition. I say, Sita, honey, you are carrying this book thing too far. She is crying. She says, I don't want to go home. You can't make me go home. I bend down to take a hand, and she knocks the flashlight out of my hand. Kid shines his big torch on her. I say, Sita Lee, get up from there. She screams, I hate you. You said Daddy was dead. I want to slap her to death after all she has put me through. Kid says,
young lady, you heard your mother. Now get up out of that closet and stop your foolishness.
Sita doesn't budge. She stays hunkered down with her arms wrapped around her knees and says, y'all are all sons of bitches. Well, Kid has had it, and so have I. He reaches down and jerks her up to her feet, and I say, it's all right, Kid, it's all right. But I'm glad somebody has jerked her up. She needs some jerking, if you ask me. I put my hands on her shoulders and tell her, listen, kiddo, stop being so dramatic right this instant, you hear me? Now let's go get in the car and go home. The child stares at me like she's about to spit in my face. Kid says,
Vivi, do you want me to handle this for you?
I say, no, thank you, Kid. Excuse us for just a minute, would you please? I grab Sita and walk her over to Niecy's station wagon. By the time we get there, she's sobbing. Keep an eye on her, will you, Caro, I say, and don't dare let her out of this car. I straighten my hair that must look like hell in all this humidity and walk over to Kid. He's standing by his car with his foot propped on the running board. In spite of myself, that man still gives me goosebumps like he did when he was a quarterback. You cannot think like that, I tell my shriveled up insides. I give him a little kiss on the cheek and say, thank you, darling. Everything will be fine. I've just got a high-strung daughter on my hands, that's all.
He says, well, I sure hate to see you have to go through this.
I know, Kid, I tell him, like he has no idea of half of it. Now listen, you and Nona absolutely must come over sometime soon. It has been too long.
Yeah, Vivi, he says, like he still wants me.
When I get back in the car, Sita is sitting there shaking and doing her damn hyperventilating trick. She grabs on to me and won't let go. I don't know why she does that. I am not a child psychologist. Her palms are hot and sweaty against my arm. I want to push her away from me. I don't like it when my children get close to me when I'm not in the mood. We finally get her home, and I draw a bath for her and hand her one of the Darvons that I always keep around the house for cramps. Then, when she's done, I go and lie down in the bed with her. It's cool and dry in her room, and the curtains are open with a little sliver of light spilling in from the porch light. We both love it in the summer when it is scorching hot outside but real cool inside with that huge central air conditioner blasting away. I kiss her on the forehead. Precious, I tell her. You have got to stop taking things so seriously. Your father came home just like I knew he would. Is that all you were worried about? She says, Mama, I don't feel like talking. I'm too tired. I say, well then, I'll talk and you listen. You can't run away from things, Siddeley. You've got to stay in this house where your life is. Don't you think I want to run off and hide in a bookmobile or join the circus? We all do. But we have responsibilities. She rolls away from me onto her side. I can feel the little bumps of her seersucker nightgown against my fingers. I stroke her hair and kiss her neck. You are magnificent, I tell her. You are my most beautiful, intelligent child. I adore you. Don't ever run away from me again. I kiss her one more time before I leave the room. I still have guests in the house. It's late, but I fix a round of drinks for everyone, except for Mother, of course. She has put the other kids to bed and just sits there, pursing those chapped lips, acting like a martyr. Shep stands behind me, rubbing my shoulders. I don't even know when he showed back up. He says,
Thank you, Vivian. You did good.
You're welcome, I tell him. See? I don't just sit on my butt and eat Ritz crackers. When the yah-yahs leave, I take off my makeup and cleanse my face. I rub on my cold cream. I don't care how tired I am. I never go to sleep without doing my cleansing ritual. Then I go and peek into Sitta's room. There she is, propped up like the Queen of Sheba against the pillars, holding her flashlight and reading. Not even trying to hide it. I am so mad I want to slap her, reading, laying up in bed, relaxing after all the shit she has put me through. But I do not say a word. I tiptoe down the hall to the kitchen. I reach up to the pill cabinet and get myself a Darvon, too, and swallow it with a jigger of bourbon. That child is not going to get all the attention in this family. I work hard as hell in this house, and I'm sick to death of never getting what I want. I swear I could write a book about all the things no one has ever thanked me for. In summertime, the child just lives for the bookmobile, which is the whole reason why she hid up in there and rode downtown and let them lock her up. She thinks books are her best friends, and she wanted to be surrounded by them. I understand. None of this is strange to me. I am her mother, though, and it is my job to teach her that you cannot escape from life. Life is not a book. You can't just set it down on the coffee table and walk away from it when it gets boring or you get tired.
Cruelty to Animals.
Little Shep, 1964. Buggy, my mama's mama. He's got the meanest little lapdog you ever laid eyes on. One of those puny butt poodles that's nothing but bone and fluff. And to Buggy, that dog can't do any wrong. It can pee or poop or tear up the bedspread. And Buggy just says, isn't that just the darlingest thing you have ever seen? Even though I don't care for yap butts like that dog, I still think an animal ought to get treated with some respect and not like a nutcase, which is what Buggy has been turning that puffball into. My daddy says Buggy is going to drive that animal as crazy as she did her daughter. See, I'm real fond of dogs myself. Yard dogs, that is. We got three of them at Pecan Grove, and I'm the one that gets up early in the morning to feed them. They get a cut or scrape, I'm the one that cleans it. We got a Catahoula hound named Jep, who is so dumb that once he ran into a telephone pole and knocked himself out cold while he was chasing my daddy's truck. We also got Lamar, a German shepherd that Mr. Charlie Vandalick gave us. And we got Jolene, a white collie that Lulu picked out from my cousin's dog Josie's second litter. Josie was a dog famous for her ability to sleep standing up. She got shot with porcupine quills once when Daddy took me and her deer hunting with him in West Texas, and I'm the one that pulled them out of her, one by one. I still got those quills in a pickle jar in my bedroom. I'm saving them for when I'm a vet. Gonna put them in my office to remind me of my first surgery, because removing those quills was an operation for me, that's for sure. You just try and pull dozens of quills out of a collie. It hurts them something awful, and they're all crying and squirming, but you've got to pull those quills out, or they'll hurt even worse, maybe even get an infection. You can have those lap dogs, though. I'm scared I'll step on them, and that'll be all she wrote. Plus, they don't fetch or hunt or roll in the grass with you, anything. They just sit up there on the couch waiting for their favorite soap opera to come on. My daddy says it is just like your mama's mama to take up with some animal the size of a rat. Buggy named that poodle Miss Peppy and got her this wicker bed with a plaid mattress, crocheted a green and white striped sweater for the dog to wear in winter, and got one of the Alta Society ladies to make a special bowl with Miss Peppy written on the side. Buggy drives all over town in her Fairlane with that dog beside her tearing up the seat covers, and you can see her talking to that animal the whole time. My grandmother always drives with the windows up, whether her air conditioner is working or not. She says it is trashy to drive around in public with roll-down windows. And, of course, she feeds Miss Peppy canned dog food. That dog has never eaten a table scrap in its life. My daddy says if a dog can't live off table scraps, then it's not a dog. He says if a dog can't live out in the yard no matter what the season, then it might as well be a goddamn stuffed animal at the Louisiana State Fair. I'll bet you the reason Miss Peppy is so nuts is due to the way her head squeezes her brain in like a fist. I don't blame the dog for being crazy. Dogs are dogs. You teach them to obey, you feed them what's left over from supper, and you pick cockle burrs out of their coats. You don't pull a dog up on the couch with you and talk to it like a human baby and wait for it to talk back to you in plain English. You don't take a creature and breed it so it can't fit inside its own skin, which might be what started Miss Peppy's problem in the first place. Once when Miss Peppy was in heat, this Shelty, down the street from Buggy, got her pregnant. When her time came, it was a sad case, let me tell you. We were all over at Buggy spending the night because my daddy was off duck hunting and Mama didn't want to stay at Pecan Grove because of her nightmares. We were all laid up in Buggy's den watching Saturday Night the movies, eating peanut butter fudge, when that dog went into labor. Buggy had set her up in the utility room with a heater and a transistor radio turned on, and we were reaching a high point in the movie when Miss Peppy started this high, sharp moaning. I ran in there to see what was happening, and I tell you, it was truly something awful. I've seen plenty of puppies born at Pecan Grove and at my cousin's. It didn't scare me, but that dog was being ripped apart. Made me glad I wasn't a girl. We all hovered around, but we couldn't do a single thing to help her. Buggy got all upset and started lighting some novena candles, and Mama yelled, "Mother, stop being so sanctimonious." I said, "Hey, Mama, Dr. Fitzsimmons would know what to do. He always knows what to do with Daddy's cows." And Mama yelled out to Buggy, "Blow out those damn candles and go warm up the car." Then I looked up the number, and Mama called Dr. Fitzsimmons' telephone answering service. I'm going to have me one of those when I'm a vet, and I'll work on large and small animals, just like Dr. Fitzsimmons. Buggy said, "Oh, I'm scared to touch her. I might cause her even more pain." I scooped Miss Peppy up in a blanket, because it didn't look like anyone else was going to make a move.
Dr. Fitzsimmons left a party just to meet us at the clinic, and he worked for 2 hours while we waited in the lobby that smelled like disinfectant. Mama just smoked cigarettes, and Buggy mumbled prayers under her breath. Then Dr. Fitzsimmons came out with a lab coat over his slacks and said, "Ms. Abbott, Vivi, I'm real sorry. I pulled the bitch through, but couldn't save the litter. I recommend you spay her for her own health." Buggy stood there sobbing and fingering a rosary and muttered, "Don't you dare call Miss Peppy names." Mama said, "Thank you for your good work, Dr. Fitzsimmons. We're lucky to have you in this town." Buggy said, "I suppose it's the will of Jesus." Mama said, "Mother, did you hear what Dr. Fitzsimmons said about the hysterectomy?" "Yes," my grandmother snapped. "Don't talk nasty. Of course I heard. I'm not deaf yet. It will be taken care of. We must think of the safety of the mother first and foremost." It wasn't too long after Miss Peppy got spayed that Buggy started up with the baby dolls. Her mission in life became to train that dog to treat those dolls like they were her own puppies. We watch Buggy do it all the time. She spends whole afternoons teaching Miss Peppy to carry those baby dolls around in her mouth. She makes the dog drop them real gentle on Buggy's own bed. And then she teaches that animal to pull the covers up over them like they are actual human babies getting tucked in for a nap. Every time we go over there, Buggy has to show it off. She says, "Y'all come see what a good mother Miss Peppy is." And we have to troop into Buggy's bedroom where she has this prayer kneeler she conned off some nun. The kneeler is facing this Sacred Heart of Jesus bleeding like a stuck pig up there on the wall. There are still a couple of stains on it from that time I smeared ketchup on the picture to make it look more real-like. Off to the side of her bed, Buggy has a statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary with a bunch of flowers that Buggy picks fresh every day. "Just look at what a good mama Miss Peppy is," Buggy says. "Can't y'all just imagine how proud the Blessed Mother is of her?" And she makes the dog tuck her babies under the covers over and over again, and we all have to say, "Oh, Buggy, that is wonderful, just wonderful." I whisper to Sitta, "Buggy is nuts. She belongs in the same asylum we're going to drive Mama to. And those dolls are butt ugly." Buggy hears me whispering, and she says, "This is not pretend. Y'all hear, Buggy? This is 100% true. If y'all just pretend those are Miss Peppy's babies, she will know. You can't just pretend. You really have to believe." And we all look at each other like, "Yeah, right. No wonder this dog is so weird." If you so much as lean over to touch those baby dolls around Miss Peppy, she will bite your fingers off. Buggy has her believing she has to protect those babies from everything. Sometimes I think about calling up Dr. Fitzsimmons and reporting Buggy for cruelty to animals. But Sitta says you can't turn in your own grandmother. One Saturday, Mama and Teensy are heading out to Lafayette to go shopping for the day, and we get dropped off at Buggy's. The minute we hit the kitchen door, you can hear that dog yipping. You can hear her little toenails tapping against the wood floor while she runs down the hall. Buggy lets those toenails get so long, it's like Miss Peppy is wearing little poodle high heels. My daddy told Buggy once, "If you don't trim that dog's toenails, someone is going to report you to the ASPCA. After that, Buggy keeps that poodle away from my daddy. She doesn't believe in cutting Miss Peppy's toenails because she says it depresses Miss Peppy. But you better believe she gets scared when my daddy threatens her with punishment from a big organization. Buggy is terrified of big organizations. She says they're all in cahoots with each other. For instance, she thinks the communists have infiltrated the NASA space program to ruin the weather so they can destroy the Catholic Church. Every time we have a hurricane, she says, 'See, what did Buggy tell y'all?'
Anyway, this particular Saturday, Mama is in a hurry to get off to the Lafayette stores, and she just barely sticks a head in the screen door to kiss Buggy and say when she'll be back. Well, as soon as she opens that door, Miss Peppy jumps up on her and tears her stockings to shreds right there on her legs. Without missing a beat, Mama backhands that little dog, and it goes flying through the air and lands over by the water heater. I go over to check on her, and she isn't really hurt, just sort of stunned. Mama says, "I'm sorry, Mother, but someone has got to teach that animal how to behave." Buggy clenches her teeth all up and says, "Don't you worry about Buggy and her dog. Buggy will stay home with your children and the dog that loves her. You go on and have a good time shopping with your girlfriend. Don't feel guilty about torturing one of God's little creatures." Buggy always talks about herself like she's some other person. She'll say, "Buggy is so tired," or "Buggy has to go to the Piggly Wiggly for some carrot juice," or "Buggy is getting very upset with y'all for doing that," or "Buggy and Baby Jesus both are getting upset." When she drags Baby Jesus into it, you know you'd better watch out. So Mama takes off. It's raining, and I feel like breaking all of Buggy's stupid little knickknacks that cover every inch of a house. I hate being stuck in that place with the yappy dog and all those tiny statues of little peasant children and the three wise men who stay out all year next to the praying hands planter. We turn on cartoons and lay down on the rug with pillows to watch The Roadrunner, my all-time favorite. That whole house smells like dog, even though Buggy burns church incense at least once a day. From the den, I can see into the kitchen. It's clean and everything, but there are matches all over the floor. There are always matches all over Buggy's floors. I don't know if she's too blind to see them or if she puts them there on purpose. With Buggy, you just never know. One time I tried picking the matches all up for her, and she said, "Oh, no, don't pick those up. It'll bring bad luck." I concentrate on the TV for a while, but it's so stuffy in there. I say, "Buggy, could we please open a window?" She says, "No, Miss Peppy has been fighting off a cold." I stare back at my cartoons. Sitta has one of her library books, so she's okay. Lulu's dunking graham crackers into her milk and stuffing as many as she can into her mouth. Bayla is walking around the house looking at the photographs on the walls like he always does. He asks Buggy every single time we go over there, "Who is that, Buggy? When was that? Where was that taken?" And Buggy is happy to tell him Bayla thinks that whole hallway is his own private museum. The Roadrunner gets over with, and the only things on the TV are stupid. So me and Sitta and Lulu get out the Sears catalog and start cutting it up. We cut up models and things and glue them back together in different ways. It's an old game of ours. You can play it anywhere, because almost everybody has a old Sears catalog laying around the house. I cut off the head of a man modeling underwear and stick it on a power saw. Sitta cuts off a lady's legs and pastes them coming out of a baby's ears. Whoever makes the weirdest thing wins. We never get tired of that game. And when we're done, we leave all the scraps of paper and the paste and scissors and everything all over the floor. At Buggy's, we never clean up a single thing. We just sit back and watch her do it. We make deliberate messes because we know she'll clean them up. She'll sigh like you're driving nails through her palms, but she always bends over and cleans them up like she's our servant. So then we have to go and admire Miss Peppy and her babies again before Buggy will fix us any lunch. Finally, we get some grilled cheeses and tomato soup, but Miss Peppy can't take it that we're getting something she isn't, so she pees right on the rug next to where I have my grilled cheese on paper towel. And that is when I get my famous idea. I don't say a word about that dog peeing right next to my sandwich. I wait until Buggy is straightening up after lunch, and then I say, "Hey, y'all, let's go in the grandchildren's room and play." Buggy says, "Little shrimp, You sure are being good today.
I grin and lead Sitta, Lulu, and Bela down the hall to the room where we sleep when we spend the night and where all our toys are. Once I have them all in there, I shut the door and tell them,
All right, now listen to me, here. Y'all want to have some fun?
Yeah,
Bela says.
Uh-huh,
Lulu says, chewing a piece of peanut butter fudge. Sitta takes the candy away from her and says, Mama told me to keep an eye on you. You wouldn't have your weight problem in the first place if it weren't for Buggy and her homemade candy.
Shut up, I tell him. Y'all listen to me.
Even Sitta listens because she's as bored as the rest of us. I reach down into the toy chest and pull out two dolls that Sitta and Lulu have already ripped the hair off of. One of their favorite things is to rip the hair off the dolls and throw them up in the chinaberry tree and laugh at them.
Y'all see these dolls? I ask.
Uh-huh.